I think there's a lot of really intimate, quiet, intense moments, and then ones that are really kind of bursting and just like the Blue Booby piece in that way, and that it goes back and forth in that sense.
Yeah. And the family that your friend's family, I imagine they of course knew about the piece and they've heard the piece.
Yeah, of course.
Oh yeah. Yeah, how do they feel about it?
You know, it was kind of in two ways. So they've never seen it live. I just sent it to them because when it was premiered, they couldn't make it.
Right.
And I sat with them whenever I gave it to them, and it was, you know, really intense for them
Of
because
course.
it was each about one of them. And
Yeah.
I mean, there were it was, you know, a thankful, beautiful moment, but it's also still, I think it's still tough for them, you
Yeah,
know.
absolutely.
I will say, to make this piece have a Peabody connection, I was nervous about titling it what I titled it and having them have direct connections with people and a certain moment, because I didn't want to offend anyone and I felt like really vulnerable
Of
in this
course.
work and scared. And what made me more confident in it was actually talking to Michael Hirsch, who's on faculty at Peabody. He's one of the composition people. And a lot of his works have similar impetus for them. And this was kind of about the time that On the Threshold of Winter was being completed. Well, he had completed, but about to be performed by Al Young. And oh God, what was the group called? The ensemble that came. They're really fine. They're an amazing group. You can put that in later, maybe. I don't remember.
It's
but
is if it's on the recording that
I mean, certainly it is.
is it the same as on the recording? Because I think if it's the recording that is, say, on Spotify, we can
I think so.
find the name of it. Because I was listening to Michael Hirsch's music the other day, so I'll
It's
be able
amazing. He's
to.
a really amazing composer.
Yeah.
But I talked to him actually when I came here for my interview at Peabody. I talked to him and I told him, you know, I was really nervous about these aspects of it. He said, you know, I was going to do something similar with my piece On the Threshold of Winter, and I was not going to really open up about how it came to be and why I wrote it because I didn't want to bring in my other people into this outside of my or inside my personal life, and I didn't want them to feel awkward or offended. But in the end, I talked to them, and this meaning I'm talking for Michael Hirsch, that they felt comfortable and empowered by it. And so for me, I felt similar in my work. I thought that the impetus was too great to just call it Wind Trio movements one and two, you know? So
I had seen
it's.
I had seen Awe on the cover of an album on Spotify, and it's actually different pieces. On the Threshold of Winter isn't available there, so I can't find what the ensemble is. But anyway.
Yeah. But I think where pieces come from for me is important, and it's up to, you know, each person who in their work how they feel about letting know what the impetus is for each work, and it's up to every person. But for me, it's important and comfortable. Or maybe no, it's not comfortable. That's not right. It's
Well,
important and vulnerable is what I meant to say, vulnerable. But that's a big part of the art that I make as well, is trying to investigate vulnerability as a place of strength, because it is scary. But I think that for me, the greatest works come from these places. For me, as a listener and a creator, I really try and engender vulnerability and empathy in any of the works that I create. And hopefully, when they're performed, the performers and the listeners and the conductor, anybody who's consuming that art can really find a place like that in the work. And I hope so.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you kind of want to go through that sense of discomfort to be able, I mean, you mentioned in error the word comfortable, but I think going through that discomfort, having that vulnerability that enables that discomfort can eventually lead to more comfort after experiencing that it's like, having consonants resolve from dissonance.
And I think that if we're gonna talk about consonance and dissonance, I think in music today and in art today, for me, consonants and dissonance are really big topics and really important topics that are explored a lot. Mm-hmm. And for me specifically, I don't really think of that as intervallic ratios, just like close intervals being dissonance and consonants being like chords or changing of chords to different chords that are either consonant or dissonant or regression or whatever, you know,
recognizable progression as a specific harmony or whatever.
Yeah. For me, more so what is bigger now and what I think is awesome is exploring what consonants dissonance mean in each piece and how it evolves. So there's certain moments that are really consonant dissonant. So like, for example, from an older piece from the 20th century, like Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, which is by Penderecki, regularly considered very, very dissonant.
Right.
But I think for that the piece world, though, it's not. Yeah. I mean, it's the world it creates. It's that way. And the intense quote unquote dissonance for that time creates like that is the consonant world of that piece
in my opinion.
And so whenever things get outside of that, I think are when we have an actual like dissonance. So I think that's kind of what a lot of people, including myself, are really interested in lately is exploring what dissonance means and what consonance means in each work as we traverse it in its creation and performance.
As opposed to consonants being defined by what one knows about consonants from listening to other works, older works, where consonance was established for hundreds of years. Right. And now that we are at a point where we can think about consonants in the context of the work itself, instead of in the context of listening to another work, which could possibly distract from listening to the work you're listening to.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. If you're just being obsessed with interval ratios and progressions, it's like, well, I mean, I think you're limiting yourself to how you're listening to music. Mm-hmm. For example, like if we go back to Hirsch, like in On the Threshold of Winter or in The Vanishing Pavilions is like 2.5 hour solo piano piece.
Yeah.
Each one of those starkly intense and just, I mean, unwielding in how much energy and inertia and gravity there is in each of those works. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it from the other perspective of just like interval ratio and progressions and those kind of things, there's a lot of dissonance. But I think the moments that really stick out in it are whenever it has like a pocket in time of like sudden delicacy and really beautiful, I don't like to use that word, like really gentle serenity, you know.
I find a lot of composers who come on my show don't like to use the word beautiful because it's a word that is beaten to death and is used it's such a narrow description.
It's vacuous It means nothing. Like I personally find Hirsch's works very beautiful,
right?
As do I Kevin Putz's works. We're going to talk about composers on faculty at Peabody.
Yeah, and you studied with Kevin at Peabody.
I did study with Kevin. Yeah, so they're both very equally beautiful to me, but just in different ways, completely. Right.
Right.
So I think it's how you deal with the consonance versus dissonance in each work, and how each work is like a microcosm of your style, and how you're exploring that and its own dissonance and consonance.
Right.
Yeah.
As opposed to a standard definition of beautiful or consonant, which is very limiting.
Yes, agreed. I think it's about how you, whatever your world is in each piece that you're writing, you create what is consonant and what is dissonance. And I think that for me in the greatest works, it's that difference is made very compelling, and it's a way that I haven't maybe thought about it always. And it makes me look at it in a different way, like turning around an orb or something. I don't know.
And it probably leads to a composer's works being truer to themselves. Because
definitely.
It's in the composer's own mind instead of the consideration of what somebody else might think is consonant or beautiful, or to use one of those vacuous words.
Yeah, I mean, if you're really very concerned with that, I think that it's a little problematic. I think that maybe you are writing a certain type of music. I don't want to generalize. There's not a right or wrong way to write music.
It's a different motivation for writing the music than I think the music itself. If the concern is so heavily on what somebody else is going to think of it.
Right. Because then at that point, are we artisans? Like, are we trying to make things to be eaten?
Right.
Some people would say yes. And that's, I'm not saying that's the wrong view.
Yeah. And some people make music for that purpose.
Yeah. Which is, I highly don't believe in tiers or like planes of art. It's just art. And whatever you really, really like and you think is beautiful, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in guilty pleasure in any fashion.
Excellent. Exactly.
At all. I think that's really ridiculous when people like tell you apologetically the things that they're into. Like, oh, I'm really into X pop artists. And they're like, I know, but like, you don't need to qualify it. Like, right. I love that music too. And you don't need to give me an excuse why you like something. If you like it, it's awesome for
be
you.
Be proud.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I always tell my mom whenever we talk about art stuff, she always have the role of the curmudgeon in my house because I'm really, really picky. The older I get and the more I work, I become more and more picky with art stuff. But that's like, it's my job.
Yeah.
But I never want to impose my views on someone. That's so shitty. So like, she'll always be like, oh, I was listening to X composer the other day or X piece. And I know you probably turn your nose up and it's not serious music to you. And I'm like, Mom, it doesn't matter what I think or anybody else thinks. If you're listening to some art or looking at some art and it makes you feel a certain way that you don't get to usually feel, and it creates like this, like a sense inside of you that is only with that thing. Like, that's amazing. That's right. So awesome. And if anybody tells you it's not legit, that's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Regardless of what I think, my ridiculous insular composer view of what good art is, that's don't take a composer's advice on what good music is, because our opinion is very, very intense, and also we're competing against these people. Well, right. I don't want to say competing, but we're working together as professionals in the field, right? So, like, if you like it, it's awesome, and if you don't, it doesn't mean it's not awesome. It's just something that you're not into.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that sounds like a great closing point. We haven't talked about all of the pieces that you sent me to listen to, but I mean, what I'll do is I'll have the links to those, and you can listen to the, we talked about the Blue Booby, and we talked about Upon Viewing a Family in Mourning. You can listen to those pieces while you listen to us talk about them, and then I'm speaking to you as the listeners now. And then I'll have the links to Through Dimension. And you also sent me, you, Daniel, sent me At the Door, which I found to be a very interesting work for two voices and piano. And it starts with a knock on the lid of the piano, I saw.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It
takes At the Door quite literally, which I think is great because, I mean, yeah, titles for the music you talked about, I think, is a very... you know, I think it's so much more interesting than just, you know, Wind Trio number 2.
Yeah, I think as a whole, meaning like the greater composition community, which is very dangerous to say.
Right.
But I think that a lot of people are exploring more diversity in title, in impetus for pieces, in what they're writing and everything. Because there's still plenty of composers who give themselves like opus numbers or title their works in this way. Like one of my colleagues who writes really awesome music, it's just in a different vein than what I write and other people are doing.
Right.
From Peabody, Sean Calhoun,
he's
a lot of times he abstracts and will just write, you know, Wind Trio.
Right.
What have you. But
well, now I'll have to have him on my show because I haven't had I haven't had on the show yet. So
So I think what's cool, especially in America, is that we have a lot of different streams that you can follow, and your music can fit in almost anywhere into that, and people will be into it, and I think in other scenes and places and countries and continents, it's a little more insular, and it's harder to carve yourself out a niche unless you're in a certain smaller stylistic cone.
Right, right.
But I think in America, that's a strength. Like, you can, there's so many different streams going on, and you can write so many different types of music right now, and it's not like one defining stylistic body happening.
Yes.
You know? So.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah. Well, it was great to talk about your views on new music and the music you compose, the music that others have composed, and that's what we that's just different perspectives we look for on this show. Student Composer of the Month for September is Daniel Sabzkabayi. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. This has been Student Composer of the Month, and there will be, like I said, recordings to listen to and scores to accompany them to peruse while you listen, or you listen to the score and to us, or you listen to the music itself. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for listening. You can keep up with our podcast every month under the Student Composer of the Month and New Music tags on WBJC.com.